Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what is being called a coup in Yemen, where rebel Houthi fighters have swept into the presidential palace in the capital Sana'a, raising concerns in Washington that America may have lost its ally in the war against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, President Hadi. Dr. Sheila Carapico, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, joins us to discuss the U.S.'s singular focus on al-Qaeda and its reliance on Saudi Arabia to stabilize Yemen, which had its own version of the Arab Spring and where the population is increasingly anxious about American drone strikes. Then we will speak with Lebanon-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest book, Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. We will first discuss the likelihood that Hezbollah will retaliate against Israel for the killing of an Iranian general on the Golan Heights, and then the revolution in Egypt and why it failed and why it will eventually come back, probably in a more violent and bloody incarnation. Then finally, we will speak with two presidential speechwriters about President Obama's upcoming State of the Union speech and the roles and rituals involved in producing these speeches that involve the input of many and the final editing of one. Paul Glastris, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly and a former special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, and David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report and a former White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, join us to discuss the upcoming State of the Union and its likely themes and focus. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was the chair of the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
Pleasure to be with you.
And it appears that there's a crisis going on in Yemen, not that it's been unstable for some time. Shia Houthi rebels apparently have shelled the president's residence. President Hadi is reportedly inside. What's your understanding of where this stands now? It's being referred to as a coup.
Yeah, it certainly looks something like a coup. I don't know that Hadi is inside. He apparently doesn't live in the presidential palace. But of course, one of the things that they did was to take over the Ministry of Information, which is at least used to be in the 60s and 70s. I mean, the kind of main way you could tell a coup had happened in African countries and some Arab countries. So I don't know that they're really trying to take over the government, but they certainly want their demands met and are exercising a fair amount of military muscle.
And what are the demands of the Shia Houthi rebels?
Well, you know, they started when they started this campaign back in like September. I mean, some of it was things like restoring fuel subsidies. Now they seem particularly focused on changing the terms of the draft constitution, which was published just last week, I think. And in particular, they, but not only they, object to a kind of, to my mind, slightly strange federal arrangement, which would divide the country into six regions. And ironically, the Houthis, who are from the far north, have that objection to the draft constitution in common with the southern movement, who also doesn't like the federal proposal.
But it appears that the Houthi rebels have been successful in making alliances with various military units, either allied or against the government. So what's the nature of those arrangements?
Yeah, that is an excellent question and a very difficult one to answer because I mean, you or your listeners might recall that in the spring, it was actually mid-March of 2011, the military, there was an incident in which snipers fired on 50-some protesters, and the military split at that point and has been fairly splintered ever since. And the important commander, Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar, who defected from President Saleh, had been the commander in a series of small, they call them wars or skirmishes against the al-Houthis during the previous decade. And so we can see that there are a lot of fractures within the military. But it's difficult, I think, for anyone, maybe even including, you know, people very much on the ground and in the know, to see exactly how those alliances break down, in part because it's almost certain that they shift.
Well, much of the reporting that I've seen here in our press has been, I think, pretty superficial, to be charitable, suggesting that somehow the Houthi rebellion and perhaps a coup, it will help al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I mean, the Houthis are Shiite, so I can't imagine how that could ever help the Sunni al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who, of course, consider the Shia apostates.
It's a little bit, just on one point, I mean, it's a little bit misleading to call them Shia, although what they are, which is Zaydi, is an offshoot of Shia Islam, but it's different than what we think of as like the Iranian 12er version. Having said that, though, yes, they are very much at odds and have been embattled with al-Qaeda and the other self-declared Sunni jihadists. And so, yeah, I don't quite understand why anyone would say that it would help al-Qaeda, except in a sort of double reverse whammy kind of way of maybe people who were opposed to the al-Houthis would become enamored of al-Qaeda because al-Qaeda is fighting against the al-Houthis. But in the short run, it certainly seems to weaken rather than strengthen the self-declared Sunni jihadists.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko, Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond. She was previously chair of the Political Science Department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy, Promotion, Justice and Representation. And we seem, of course, to be completely focused on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And has this obsession with al-Qaeda, do you think, blinded the U.S. to these other, obviously, tectonic movements taking place? I mean, have we not focused on perhaps what this society needs? I mean, I can't imagine the Houthis who have been marginalized rebelling entirely out of some power grab. There must be some roots of discontent there.
Oh, there is. Yes, many roots of discontent, that was well put. And particularly when they first arrived in Sana'a, the leader delivered quite a inspiring speech in many ways, you know, kind of listing so many of the demands. And I think what you've suggested, that U.S. obsession with al-Qaeda and purely with security matters has diverted attention from, you know, very, very urgent social and political concerns. And then related to that also, I think, is an undue faith in the ability of Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf monarchies to kind of help Yemen and lead it to, you know, greater stability, when, to the contrary, I think the role of the Saudis in particular is destabilizing. And also the American drone policies or attacks have, you know, contributed to the delegitimation of the al-Hadi government.
Well, let's start with the first of those, the Saudis. inability to help. I mean, obviously, this is this very repressive monarchy in Saudi Arabia. They're not particularly, I mean, they've been funding the counter-revolution in Egypt. They're not exactly interested in any kind of pluralism. So what has been the nature of their support for the Yemen government that's now collapsing?
Well, after the uprising began against Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had been in power for 30 years, eventually, you know, over the rest of 2011, essentially, the Gulf Cooperation Council came up with a proposal that is unfortunately frequently referred to as the GCC initiative, as, you know, kind of putting the emphasis on the donors as providing the solution. And, of course, the U.S. being an ally of the Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries, has the U.S. and also Britain and France have backed the so-called GCC initiative. But it's really been pretty moribund in the sense that they had a lot of international consultants come in and they came up with this federal proposal and so forth, but didn't deal with the concerns of the al-Houthis, who felt marginalized by it. It kind of kept the former ruling party more or less in power, even though Ali Abdullah Saleh was removed. And also at the same time, he, you know, remains in the country and very politically active. And one of the real mysteries, I think, that's very difficult to get at, is, as in my response to your first question, is what role he is playing personally or the elements of the army that still remain loyal to him. And many people say, and some of them who sound to me like they ought to know what they're talking about, although I'm not 100% certain myself, you know, that he's really facilitated the rise of the al-Houthis and their military successes in Sana'a, in particular in the capital city. But it's certainly clear that many elements of the army are just not fighting against the al-Houthis.
Well, there wasn't there a sort of manifestation of the Arab Spring, which I imagine, you know, was certainly something the Saudis wouldn't welcome?
Yes, actually. I kind of deviated from your question. No, I think one way of reading the so-called GCC initiative was really to take hold of what saw itself as a revolutionary movement and make sure that it didn't upset the long-standing arrangement, which is basically that, you know, Saudi Arabia is kind of the hegemon, if you will, in the Arabian Peninsula, and particularly vis-a-vis Yemen, which is the most populous country in the peninsula.
And extremely poor by comparison.
Extremely poor by comparison. I mean, you know, the Saudi poverty level, I think, is the same or even higher than the average income in Yemen. And the Saudis provide aid, but now they're pulling it back and they're building a wall to prevent immigration into the kingdom, which used to be quite a big source of revenue for individual families. And also, you know, historically, Saudi Arabia has funded various political actors, whether tribal leaders or military leaders or politicians, and, you know, interferes very deeply in Yemeni politics. And I think, you know, the result has been, that's part of the reason, I think, why Ali Abdullah Saleh lasted so long. And at the same time, it's been very destructive.
So, Sheila Karapiga, let's turn then to the other issue that you brought up, which was the American drone attacks. They are deeply unpopular, I understand, with the Yemenis.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, initially, I think there was some faith that they, you know, they were very well targeted against al-Qaeda. But two things happened, well, several things happened to turn public opinion very strongly against it. One is, of course, that, you know, sometimes they blow up a wedding, kill children, you know, miss their targets, target the wrong people, stuff like that. The other thing is that in many communities, drones, at least in some periods, there was a period last August, maybe July to August, but other periods as well, when there'll be drones over a community, sometimes for weeks. And that means you've got this thing that you can hear flying above. You usually can't see it. And then periodically it strikes. It is extremely anxiety-provoking for, you know, families of innocent people living in those communities. And the other thing is that it hasn't stopped Al-Qaeda. So, I mean, it's hard to see the upside of the drones for Yemen. And again, the fact that both presidents, in fact, Saleh and Hadi, have supported it is one of the reasons why they're so unpopular.
Well, we've learned from the recent terrorist attacks in Paris that one of the brothers who conducted the attack on the satirical magazine in Paris had made a number of trips to Yemen. So I'm curious about what kind of an open door policy they have. You know, I mean, is it because it's sort of a failed or a semi-failed state that jihadists can do these sort of tourist trips that they do? Or, you know, you'd think that given our focus on Al-Qaeda that the U.S. would be watching who's coming and going in Yemen.
Well, it's a couple of things, and some of them are not even mildly insidious. I mean, one of them is that Yemen has just always had a very liberal entry visa policy. That they accept a lot of refugees. I mean, you can imagine the refugees who are trying to get into Yemen, but they are from Somalia and Eritrea. They took in a lot of Vietnamese. They've been, you know, they were for quite a long time actually trying to encourage and doing fairly well because the Arabic spoken in Yemen is very good Arabic. And so having people come to study Arabic was a policy that the government was supporting. And, you know, a fair number of those people were just, you know, people like me in a younger age or something like that. I mean, not going to study jihad. But, you know, some of them did. And at the same time, the government is not in a position now, at least, to monitor very well who's coming and going.
Well, apparently John Walker Lynn, the so-called American Taliban, studied in Yemen.
Right, right. But, I mean, that's an example, and that's true. And actually, I remember the story of his mother, like, calling the embassy and calling around and saying, you know, I'm really worried about my son. And the American embassy saying, oh, you know, this is, you know, you're just worrying unnecessarily, Mom. And she wasn't. But at the same time, I mean, he was one of, you know, dozens and dozens of Americans and others who, you know, really did go to study Arabic.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Sheila Karapiko, to try and understand the Shia nature of the Houthis, and as you've mentioned, that they're a sect, if you will, I suppose a bit like the Alawites are in Syria, of Shiism, the Zaydism. So tell me, is there a role for Iran here? Because obviously the Saudis and the Yemenis have accused Iran of meddling.
You know, there's been a lot of people trying to verify those allegations, and I still haven't seen really. I think it's pretty clear that Iran wants influence, perhaps claims influence. And then on the other side, of course, the Saudis, I think, have a vested interest in, and so does the Yemeni government, in a sense, in blaming, you know, outside agitators. This is not a problem, you know, our people have. This is, you know, outside agitators. But it's pretty clear, and we certainly don't have time to go into all of the historical facts, but if you look at the historical facts, the role of Zaydism in the northern part of Yemen, there isn't a long history, for example, of, you know, people from the Zaydi community or the al-Houthis themselves going to Iran to study, or of Iranians coming to Yemen to teach, those kinds of things. So, you know, there may be some influence. I suspect it's more now than it was when they began their rebellion, but it still does not seem to be the decisive factor.
Well, Dr. Sheila Karapiko, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Nice talking to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was the chair of the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a Lebanese-based journalist about the possibility of Hezbollah retaliating against Israel and the failure of the Egyptian revolution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a correspondent for The Atlantic and a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest, just out, Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Ian.
And Thanasi, just to touch on what's happening now in Lebanon before we talk about Egypt, the killing of this Revolutionary Guard Corps general, along with the son of the famous Iranian Hezbollah terrorist Jihad Mughniyeh, the son of Imad Mughniyeh, that apparently has riled up the Iranians considerably and Hezbollah. And Hezbollah was recently humiliated by the revelation that the Israelis had penetrated the organization at the very top and had a spy in their ranks. There are some rumors now that Hezbollah may well be sort of forced to retaliate in some way. What are you hearing? Your family's there. Your wife writes for the New York Times from Lebanon. What's your sense of where things stand?
Well, worrisomely, it's hard to imagine politically how Hezbollah lets this pass without some kind of response. Until now, since Mughniyeh's assassination in 2008, Hezbollah has used the formula of we will respond, but at a time and place of our choosing. And that's the way they sort of deferred action and justified, we're not going to get caught in some trap of overreacting, but we're going to do something. Well, now it's been 6 years, and now this guy's son is killed, along with, as you said, the senior Iranian IRGC member in the Golan. And this does reflect, among other things, a bit of a change in what is called sort of perversely, the rules of the game, and the rules of the game are the rules that Hezbollah and Israel honor in order to keep their conflict from spilling out of control into an all-out war. Israel has avoided targeting Hezbollah operatives directly inside Syria, Hezbollah has avoided, since 2006, doing any direct strikes into Israel. Now, the concern is that they're going to feel like they have to do something, and that they'll do something that marks yet another departure from the well-established rules. And as soon as we depart from the well-established rules, that's when we have danger of conflict spinning out of control. So that's my concern.
Well, there's an extra layer of complication here, Thanasi Kambanis, and that is that within Iran itself, there's apparently a power struggle going on with the government trying to make a deal with the P5+1 to end this isolation of Iran. But the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, are resisting the nuclear deal, obviously, because they're in the business of being, you know, professional anti-American, you know, great Satanists, and they'd be the first people to be put out of business if there was a normalization. So do you think that's going to, this is also going to affect it, or perhaps even make it more likely that Hezbollah will be forced into some military action?
Well, this is, I mean, you put your finger right on one of the really important dynamics here, which is the internal fight inside Iran between, to sort of put it simplistically, reformists and these the sort of Revolutionary Guard military industrial complex. Hezbollah is clearly on the you know, allied with the IRGC in that dispute, and you know, absolutely, this is the kind of escalation that plays into that kind of alarmist conflict-driven politics. So the hardliners in the Rev Guard can say, you know, look at this, you know, Israel is attacking the Party of God in Syria. It's killing our people. It's murdering Iranian generals in the Golan. Is this really the time to give concessions to the West or shut down our nuclear program? Again, unfortunately, that sort of fear-mongering, as it does anywhere, really empowers the worst and most extreme elements.
And again, I'm speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a correspondent for The Atlantic and a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest, just out, is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. So let's turn to Egypt. And frankly, Thanasi, I'm kind of mystified as to why. Perhaps we're very fickle in terms of our press coverage. We were all fell in love with the Egyptian Revolution, and now it's become an orphan story. And I guess we're getting used to the idea of the counter-revolution under General Sisi, and we've all but forgotten this extraordinary and dramatic story.
Yeah, it's a great shame, and of course, it's sort of the blindness to history that Washington policymakers tend to exhibit. But when we think back to what happened 4 years ago, as you say, people forget that. But in fact, a process began on January 25th, 2011, in Tahrir Square, which is still ongoing today. This sort of inspiring story that captivated me as a reporter, and that really, I think, took the imagination of the world, was millions of people reinventing themselves, defying the old narratives of power, and going out there, putting their bodies and their lives on the line to try and create a more just government. Now, you know, 4 years later, the military is back in power. Most of the voices we recognize from those revolutionary times are silenced or exiled in prison or dead. The lazy reaction or the instinct is to say, oh, well, that revolution failed, or it was roundly defeated, and now we're back to an Arab world of dictators, friendly or rival despots, and that's what we have to deal with. But in fact, as we know, historical change operates on a calendar of years and decades, not of the news cycle. And that process whereby millions of citizens took power into their own hands and really made the establishment quake in its boots and fear for its future, that process is still taking place. So today we have this military government in power in Cairo. It's been in power for a year and a half, and it has had to exert more force and more repression to stay in power than any of its predecessors collectively did. Sisi has imprisoned upwards of 40,000 people for political offenses of demonstrating and gathering in public. That is not the sign of a victorious old order. That is the sign of a sort of revanchist revival that has to work 10 times harder to keep in power than the dictators that it is following. And that act of creation, that began in Tahrir Square, the act of creating new Arab politics and a new Arab order. We don't know where it's going to lead. Now, I don't think we can say it's definitely going to lead somewhere good in the end, right? We can't say destiny suggests that no matter what happens in the end, we're going to come up with a better and more just Arab order because the people rose up. That would be naive and foolish, but it would be equally naive and foolish to say that somehow that process just suddenly came to a complete stop with the restoration of a military dictatorship in Cairo last year.
So do you think, though, that, I mean, your new book, The Nasi Kambanis, Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story, is an Egyptian story. The main characters, Bassam, an apolitical middle-class architect who puts his entire family in jeopardy when he decides to join the revolution for the loftiest and most patriotic of reasons, to improve his country. And the other character, Moaz, who's a Muslim brother, who devised his own organization to join the opposition. I wonder, given how much the liberals, in a sense, I mean, let me ask you this, were the liberal revolutionaries or the more secular revolutionaries, were they conned or did they make a mistake in joining Temurud, the opposition umbrella that got rid of or became the excuse or the fig leaf to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood, and instead of replacing the Muslim Brotherhood with the democratic revolutionaries, the reactionary military people and the oligarchs came back?
Well, the fundamental mistake that the secular revolutionaries made was to be more afraid of Islamists than they were of the army. So the signal, I mean, there's a lot of errors in judgment and mistakes that we can look at in Egypt in the last 4 years, but one of the really seminal ones is the secular, somewhat liberal, I mean, they're not all liberal, but the secular, sometimes liberal opposition groups didn't realize that their strength was in supporting a pluralistic, free society based on rule of law and accountable government, and they didn't have faith that an order that was liberal would be strong enough to deal with challenges to liberalism that came from religion. And that's their fundamental error, which they're going to lose again and again until they figure out how to overcome that problem. And that's a conceptual problem, it's a cultural problem, and it's a political problem. Because in 2013, I mean, you referred to Tamara, the movement that that sort of gave Sisi the popular cover for his coup against the elected Muslim Brotherhood president. But essentially, what happened there was much more broader based than just that sort of massive demonstration that came from Tamara. What happened there was that the liberal secular establishment publicly decided that military rule and a military dictatorship would be far preferable to democratic leadership under the Muslim Brotherhood. And people forget this now, but even Mohammed el-Baradei, the Nobel Prize-winning liberal conscience of the revolution, came out and said that. Said that the Muslim Brotherhood is forcing us to make a choice, and if we have to choose, we'll choose the military. My character in the book, Bassam Kamel, he's running for parliament again right now for the elections in March and April. He just told me last week in Cairo, even today, knowing what he knows now, battling against the censorship and oppression of the Sisi regime, he said, even knowing all that, I would still today do the same thing as I did in June and July of 2013, because even this is better than the Muslim Brotherhood rule. I think we have to understand that choice in order to understand why Egypt ended up where it did. But Egyptian secularists and Egyptian liberals are going to have to choose differently in the future if they're going to ever end up with some kind of democracy of their own design.
And where's Moaz, the Muslim brother?
Moaz is in exile, and he's really, there are lots of characters like him who helped make the revolution, and it's particularly painful and sad because this guy, he grew up in the Muslim Brotherhood, and he defied his Muslim Brotherhood leaders to join the revolution. His reward for that was to get expelled from the Brotherhood, which was really a second family to him. And he proceeded to dedicate the next 4 years of his life to a few futile quest to get his secular friends and his Islamist friends to agree on a core agenda that would be sort of, you know, before we fight over the spoils of power, before we fight over how much religion to put in political life, let's all agree that we think there should be no torture in prisons and that the police should not control public life. And, you know, these sort of 5 or 10 basic things that have to do with making a just society based on rights, let's agree on that agenda, let's fight for it, let's win and secure those things, and then we can fight to the death over everything else. And that's been his agenda the whole time. And today, he's one of the few people who can sort of say he never really lost his moral compass. But he has no influence. You know, he's bouncing around mostly based in Turkey, trying to persuade all these folks. And frankly, it's very sad. A lot of them don't trust him. I mean, his Muslim Brotherhood friends don't trust him because he defied the Brotherhood, which has many sort of cult-like approaches to loyalty and discipline in its membership. And a lot of his secular revolutionary friends don't trust him because they've become such Islamophobes. And they say, you know, after what happened with Morsi and the fall of his presidency and the self-interest of the brothers, we can't trust anyone who ever was a brother, and really, once a brother, always a brother. So he's a sort of visionary idealist who's very, very lonely these days.
Well, just in closing, Thanasi Kambanis, it seems to me that it's deeply cynical, the situation where Mubarak's now being forgiven by Sisi. You say he's incredibly popular, but in effect he's economically underwritten by the Saudis, who are supporting him because they are reactionaries who are more afraid of any vestige of democracy than anything else, and also by the Israelis. So you have this peculiar alliance of Egyptian reactionaries, Saudi reactionaries, and right-wing Israelis.
Yeah, I mean, that's the truth, you know, it is, as you say, cynical. It is also, I think, untenable, and this is, you know, being untenable, it can be resolved in any number of ways. But I don't think the sort of devil's pact in which Israel and the United States and the Saudis are all investing in a really short-term solution. They're looking for a payoff today, as if they don't realize that 6 months or 2 years down the road, it's bound to explode. So they're sort of paying for having a guy on the other end of the line, a unitary single voice they can call up, and they know that on certain key issues, like counterterrorism or like the Gaza border or Israeli security interests or the Brotherhood in Saudi's case, they can get what they want. And the big picture is heading for more disaster. When that disaster hits, we'll see policymakers in Washington and Riyadh and Israel acting surprised, and really they'll be in large part the underwriters of the dynamic that leads to the next explosion.
Well, Thanasi Kambanis, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a correspondent for The Atlantic and a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest book just out is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with two presidential speechwriters about the upcoming State of the Union. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton and wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare and the budget. And also joining us is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter, and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras and David Halperin.
Great to be here.
Thank you, Ian.
And let me begin with you, Paul. There was an article in the New York Times about Cody Keenan, the chief White House speechwriter for President Obama, who Obama has christened Hemingway because of his beard. It describes his process, particularly where he had a final draft of the State of the Union speech that's coming up in about 20 minutes from now, where his close friend Benjamin Rhodes, the deputy national security advisor, worked on the speech. What was your working method with President Bill Clinton, Paul? Were you in charge of a team, or did everybody weigh in, or did you have to go off and have a scotch in the middle of the night with your friend?
No, it was much more of a team effort under Bill Clinton, and David was part of that. What would happen is that my boss, who was either Michael Waldman in 99 or Terry Edmonds in 2000, the chief speechwriter, would basically divvy up the tasks among the six of us on the domestic side, and David's team on the NSC side would write the foreign policy section, and we'd all kind of burrow, beaver away on our sections. I would do education, Laura Weiss would do environment and so forth, and Jeff Schessel would do the budget, et cetera, et cetera. And Michael would then kind of weave them together into a rough first draft. And then the real butchery would begin as different people within the senior staff would have their go at it and suggest changes. And the president himself would begin to weigh in, having earlier kind of set out his thoughts and themes. And the process would just go round and round over many, many weeks, many, many drafts, until the last few days, where it was essentially the president and 20 people in the theater on the east wing of the White House watching the president essentially rehearse the speech over the course of 3 days, over many hours a day. And at each sentence, the president would stop and not each sentence, but darn near each sentence, stop and want to tweak the sentence or ask for more words or really improve the language and make it his own. So it was about a six-week, two-month process.
And David Halperin, obviously since 9/11, there's been more focus on foreign policy in State of the Union speeches, although the president expected to concentrate on his new tax proposal. But I imagine cybersecurity and the recent terrorist attacks in Europe will come up.
I think that's right. When I was saying to you, when I worked for President Clinton, foreign policy was not a huge part of the State of the Union. It was literally just one or two paragraphs where the president would just use a lot of nouns like Russia, China, the Middle East, Milosevic, and terrorism. I mean, there really wasn't, most of the speech was devoted to domestic. But after 9/11, you saw more of President Bush and talking about terrorism, and also we were in two wars. So international issues became a bigger focus. And I think, the president still has a lot of responsibility to talk about the challenges that the United States faces in dealing with terrorism. And, terrorism's obviously been a huge issue, but also the ways we've dealt with terrorism, which has created a lot of concerns on issues from Guantanamo to drones to the NSA surveillance program. So the president has to look tough on terrorism, but also address concerns of the American people from left to right about how we're going about implementing that. But I do think the biggest focus will, again, be domestic.
And Paul Glastras, apparently, we know that the president's gone back up in the polls to 50%. And I take it in part, it's probably in large part, it's the economy. But I imagine his foreign policy landscape is looking pretty good as well, isn't he? I mean, he's
I think, yeah, I think both the economy, the economy was coming back you know, a month ago, 2 months ago, nothing's really changed. It's just that the American public are a little bit more aware of it now, and maybe gas prices are making them feel better. The foreign policy has definitely gelled. A lot of emergencies that looked as if he wouldn't be able to handle he has handled, right? Vladimir Putin is no longer, a colossus astride Eurasia, but a kind of a sad sack who we don't hear too much about anymore. But, you know, what's really happened is the president was no longer having to restrain himself policy-wise in order to support red state Democratic senators and stay his hand or shut his mouth about things like immigration and climate change. That's right. And now he is free to put out all those executive orders he told everyone he was going to put out, and nobody believed he would. And progressives, it's mostly members of the Democratic coalition coming back to supporting the president that explains this 10% rise in his approval rating. Republicans still don't like him and still think the economy is terrible and so forth. But the base voters, Democratic base voters, are suddenly, oh, the president is with me now. I see that. So that's a big part of this wind at his back.
And David Halpern, we've spoken a lot about this disgraceful racket in Washington called the private for-profit college subsidies that I think $30 to $40 billion of taxpayer money goes to these politically protected bipartisan disgrace known as the for-profit college industry, where essentially a lot of vets and young aspirants to the middle class from minority communities are saddled with onerous debts and get worthless diplomas. And yet this system continues in its zombie-like way. The president's expected to talk about beefing up the community college system, which is already in existence. And frankly, it's mystifying to me why we don't spend the money we waste on these for-profit colleges on community colleges. We'd have, I think, a much improved education landscape in this country. What's your sense of what he's going to say and whether or not any of this stuff can get implemented?
Well, he does want to invest more in community colleges. It's an important part of, I think, what he's going to talk about. And that's a good thing because, as you know, that part of the problem is that the for-profit colleges have been given free rein to mislead people and rip them off. But the other part is we haven't done in other sectors, including apprenticeships, high schools, and state universities, enough to focus on career education where people really need to be trained in things like working in tech and becoming a diesel mechanic and becoming a medical assistant, all these career options. We need to invest in that. So that's a good thing that he's doing. Unfortunately, they're still not doing enough to crack down on for-profit college abuses, and they're on the verge of approving a terrible deal between Corinthian Colleges and a debt collection company called ECMC because they're afraid that Corinthian is basically too big to fail. So it'd be nice if he continued to, because the president understands this scam, it'd be nice if he said something about it, but I doubt he will. But he will focus on this positive aspect of the agenda, which is focusing on the community colleges. I think the president, wants to talk about how he can make common cause with the Republicans in Congress, but on things like for-profit colleges, they're just bought and paid for. It's just another aspect of the corruption of their party. I think the president's really, the frame will be what can we do to work together, but I think that the reality is, here's what I'm going to do to help the country and hopefully help the middle class and help immigrants and other people by doing things on my own because the Republicans are just not playing ball.
And Paul Glastras, when you were writing for President Bill Clinton at pretty much at the same time in terms of his tenure in his second term, was he looking ahead to Al Gore's presidential run as presumably Obama's looking ahead to whoever the Democrat's going to be? And of course, the assumption is it'll be Hillary Clinton.
No question. 2 years out is a slightly early for that to be the dominant thing that senior staff are thinking about. It's certainly an issue, but the president and his staff are basically absorbed with two big things beside, what the legacy is going to be of, whether there's a Democrat, a Hillary Clinton, or somebody follows through. That's important. One is finishing off his legacy, using the next 2 years to put points on the board. You know, you've got this rare chance where you have a tremendous amount of influence and power. Clock is ticking. How much can we get done in the short time we have left? That really becomes an obsession of any good president and any good staff. And two, protect that which we've already done, right? The main successes of President Obama, the main legislative successes happened in the first 2 years when the president had 60 votes in the Senate and the House was in Democratic hands. And so fighting against efforts to undermine that are also very important. So he's thinking a lot about his legacy, finishing the things that he didn't get to do, putting in place things that will that may survive him, as well as framing the discussion so that a successful Democrat can win in 2016.
And David Halperin, do you think that the president, in the speech coming up soon, the State of the Union, will be able to, in framing his increasing taxes on really on the 1% of the 1% and changing, getting rid of the trust fund loopholes, etc., all of which really relate to the 1% of the 1%, obviously the Republicans will cry class warfare, but it seems to me that, you know, it's a pretty simple argument that what George W. Bush gave the rich, they've had a good ride. We're not doing anything radical. We're just going back to as capital gains were during the reign of Ronald Reagan, who was the hero of most of these Republican deficit hawks, who, by the way, have changed the rules on how the IRS or how the government measures the impact of tax cuts on federal revenues. So it seems to me that if the language is simple enough, this whole idea that these things aren't written in stone, they're done by politicians for political ends, and they can be undone for other political ends.
I think it's a no-brainer. I mean, the problem is the Republican Party is so much now the party of special interests. The Koch brothers in the last cycle proved their dominance in showing that they can punish people who are against them. And the 1% really do hold a lot of power. Now, my least favorite politician of all time, I think you know, is a 1%er, Mitt Romney. His speech the other day actually spoke to me. He said, under President Obama, the rich have gotten richer, the poor have gotten poorer. We need to do more to lift people out of poverty. I agree with that. Romney didn't really believe it and wasn't going to do anything about it. But I think that President Obama really has a challenge and an opportunity to actually do more to help with, you know, increase the minimum wage, help people actually build savings again so they're not using all their money to bail out their children and grandchildren and have nothing left and everyone's got huge credit card debt. There's a lot the president could do right now to protect the middle class against scams like credit cards and for-profit colleges and help the middle class to get good jobs. And I really hope that he will use his 2 years to really focus on that, to giving Americans more economic opportunity and security, because they really have lost it not just under George W. Bush, but frankly under his presidency.
And indeed, that speech by Romney did resonate with me. And Paul Glastris, obviously the messenger in this case, Mitt Romney, is perhaps a little suspect. But do you think that we are in a populist moment or a neo-populist moment or whatever? And go ahead.
I sort of do. I think I might call it, you know, more progressive than populist. But yes, I think when you have Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney both talking about the importance of upward mobility and admitting that the single biggest problem right now is wages that have been flat for a long, long time. Well, this is not what Republicans were talking about 6 months or a year ago. So it is huge for the country that at the very least both parties can agree on what the nature of the problem is, right? In 2012, the nature of the problem was not agreed upon. Republicans thought it was that, you know, job creators were being punished and there's not enough jobs and let's give some more benefit to the those who own capital and businesses. Now they're saying the big problem is the average Joe hasn't got a raise in 30 years. Well, that's real progress. There's some consensus there. It doesn't mean Republicans are going to agree with Democrats on what to do about it at all, but at least we are in agreement on the nature of the problem. And I think it's a problem that Democrats, personally, I think Democrats have better answers for and have been talking about a lot longer. And let me just also add that I think it is hard for me to fault the Obama administration on its failure to focus on wages. I think they've done a tremendous amount given the constraints on them. And in terms of going after the problems of credit card abuses, of for-profit colleges, they've done a tremendous amount. I mean, the creation of the CFPB, this agency created by Dodd-Frank, that now has the mandate and the manpower and tremendous authority to write regulations limiting predatory lending in credit cards and a lot else, has a major, major step forward. And I think we're already seeing results. It's the Obama administration that created these regulations called gainful employment rules that knocked about a quarter off the capital of for-profit colleges. You've got, the reason Corinthian Colleges is out of business is in part those gainful employment rules. And that's been blocked not by the administration, but by lobbyists working the regulatory agencies and conservatives in the judiciary. So there's a whole war going on deep within bureaucracies and on K Street that explain why you haven't seen more progress. But it's not for any lack of inventiveness or energy on the part of the Obama administration.
And David Halperin, just in the last minute, are the Republicans like Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush talking about poverty and income inequality to preempt the president? That would suggest, if that's the case, that this is a very powerful message that will resonate with the American people.
I think American people are more open to it. I think those guys are just looking for a way to market themselves and try new messages to differentiate themselves from the other 27 Republican candidates running for president. I don't really see, when you look at the GOP, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, and who's really in charge there, much of that they're going to be doing much unless they're sort of forced to help the aspirations of the middle class. I'd like to believe they will do more, because I think if they were willing, there's a lot the president could accomplish. He could accomplish a lot more. Instead, they're talking about things like gutting the authority of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that Paul talked about. So if they really want to help people, they got to stand up for champions of people like the CFPB and work with the president. I'd like to see that happen.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today. David Halperin, again, senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitutional Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And also, thank you, Paul Glastris, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton and wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to healthcare and to the budget. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thanks,
my pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.